introduction. For whatever reason, God decided that the world is going to run on politics. And no matter how much we don't like it, no matter how much it's wrong, and no matter how we even though that Gil Hoffman is the most optimistic man in Israel, no matter how many things go wrong, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided that decisions in this world will be made. They'll be made through politics. And therefore, we have to understand these politics, especially when it comes to U.S.-Israel relations, as I spoke of yesterday, we're U.S. citizens, and on the other hand, it's a very trying time for the relationship between U.S. and Israel, and we really have to understand that a little bit better. Gil Hoffman is the chief political correspondent and analyst for the Jerusalem Post, very well connected to Palestinian leaders. Every prime minister of Israel in the last bunch of years, Gil knew personally and interviewed them and spent a lot of time with them. And we have a big schuss to have such a person with such a great depth of knowledge where other people just don't have that knowledge here with us today.
Thank you so much, Rabbi, and thank you to all of you. Because I have to disagree with one thing that the rabbi said. I don't believe that the world runs on politics. I believe that the world actually runs on Torah. That the politicians, they might think that they're the ones that are having an impact and decide really what goes on. But it's really you guys over here. The learning that you do over here is what really is defending the state of Israel, and it makes a very big difference in Shemayim. So, as an Israeli and as a Jew, I want to thank you personally for all the learning that you do, because every single minute that you do of learning here, I think makes a big difference in protecting Israel and making it a better place. Whoa. That's just me. What can I do? There is politics too, and I appreciate that your yeshiva wants you to have a speaker like me who can get you up to date with what's going on right now. And it's an exciting time in Israel's history, as it tends to be. We in Israel are recovering from the impact of not one, not two, but four elections, and there's still one along the way. We last week had the anniversary of the election in America. There was the election in Israel in February, the election in June in Lebanon, and a couple weeks later there was an election in Iran, sort of. And those four elections all will have a big impact in Israel's future. Then there's the election that the Palestinians are going to have maybe at some point. It was set for January. Apparently today they announced it's going to be not in January. I don't really think anyone really thought it would be in January, but they did. They announced that it would be for a while. And that could end up being the most fateful election of them all for Israel's future. But I, as a political correspondent of the Jerusalem Post, my main focus has been to follow the impact of the first two, of the elections in the United States and the elections in Israel, in which Israelis and Americans went in very different directions. Americans elected a Democrat. Israelis elected a Republican. Americans elected an idealist. The Israelis, not so much, very much a realist, Netanyahu. Americans went to the ballot box scarred by as yet unsuccessful war. Israelis went to the ballot box scarred by as yet unsuccessful peace processes. And that made Israelis and Americans go in very different directions. I've been following very closely over the last couple years the way Israelis see the President of the United States, Barack Obama. Is everyone here American, or have you got Canadians in the room too? Okay, I'm sorry, I don't know. No, I love Canada. I just happen to not know too much about your political system, and I'm sorry. Okay. So I want you to know that will be my last mention of Canada for the rest of the time here. If you want to leave... So I'm going to focus on, for a little bit, on the relations between Israel and the United States, because this does affect the entire world. Now, at first, when Obama first started making the headlines here, Israelis didn't understand what all the fuss was about. If you remember that what Israelis look for in a leader is different than what Americans look for. Israelis look for ideally someone with military experience that proves leadership. They look for someone who has as much political experience as possible, and as much as humanly possible. Shimon Peres, our president, was first elected to the Knesset in 1959. That's older than your parents, and they didn't understand why Americans wanted someone who didn't have that kind of experience. Certainly not dealing with the Middle East, to the point that this is a headline from the Maariv newspaper in January 2008, at the beginning of the campaign. And since I'm sure you've got wonderful thought classes here at your yeshiva, I don't have to translate for you if you can read it, but I will anyway. The headline is, "Worries in Jerusalem, Obama is coming closer to the presidency." Oy vey. That was at the beginning. But he really tried to reach out to Israelis. He came here to Sderot. He, at the height of the rocket attacks, and said, "If my house were under attack or my two daughters sleep at night, I'd do everything possible to stop it." And Israelis appreciated that he went there when a lot of people weren't going there. At the end of the campaign, Israelis saw him differently, to the point that the word that I heard most from Israelis when describing Obama at the end of the campaign was the word "mavrik," which is interesting, because "maverick," you know, was the word most associated with the other guy, with McCain. But "maverick" and "mavrik" don't mean the exact same thing. "Mavrik" means shiny, brilliant, and cool. Everything Israelis see in America, or at least want America to be. That's the way they saw Obama, to the point that at the end of the campaign, the headline in Maariv was very different. Here it is. Here he is looking all angelic. With you don't really have an American flag at the top of our paper. And the headline is? "He has a dream." Taken after, I guess, the only other African-American public figure Israelis have heard of. So he really did come a long way. And at the start, when Netanyahu took over, his people believed that he could get along with Obama quite well. I remember Natan Sharansky was close to Netanyahu telling me Obama and Netanyahu have a lot in common. They both believe in reaching out to the grassroots. Netanyahu's campaign for prime minister focused on reaching out to the Palestinian people, not their corrupt leadership, but the people, and improving their daily lives and giving them hope for the future. And his policies have done that. And Obama has proved during the campaign that he knew how to maximize the rank and file, the people, in a campaign more than anyone ever had before. But I remember that Sharansky also said at the time, he said, "Israel and America, though, don't have to agree on everything. That what causes problems between countries is not disagreements, it's surprises. One country cannot surprise the other. That's what causes problems." And what happened when Netanyahu went to the White House for the first time in mid-May? Obama gave him a very big surprise when he told him that he's going to be insisting on him stopping all construction anywhere in Yehuda v'Shomron. He didn't use those words. He said West Bank. Even in Jerusalem. This surprised Netanyahu. Only then did he realize that Obama would be breaking agreements that Israel had reached with both the Bush and Clinton administrations about where Israel could and could not build in the West Bank, in Judea and Samaria. And the reason why Obama did this was he thought that if he puts a little bit pressure on Israel, then the Palestinians will make concessions that they had not made in the past. It didn't work. It only stiffened their positions, and made them say, well, if this is what they're demanding now, we won't meet with any Israeli until all construction everywhere stops. Even though there had been negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians for 16 years, while there was building in Judea and Samaria going on. So Israel found itself in a very strange place, whereby the Palestinians were taking a step backward in the peace process by setting new preconditions. The Americans were taking a step backward in the peace process by breaking agreements that there had been between Israel and American governments over the last 16 years. While Israel was moving full speed ahead, I don't know if that's the way it's portrayed in the American media, but that's the truth. Netanyahu insisted on removing 2/3 of the security checkpoints in the West Bank, even though his generals told him not to, taking a big security risk in order to improve the lives of the Palestinian people and their freedom of movement. Netanyahu came out in favor of a Palestinian state demilitarized, which he did not during the campaign. And Netanyahu insisted on keeping the percentage of the West Bank that's populated by Jews at the same percentage it's been for a long time now. If you watch the news in America, you would think it would be maybe like 50% of Judea and Samaria populated by Jews. Maybe 80%. How about 1.7%? That's all. 1.7% of the actual land in Judea and Samaria has Jews living there. Not that big a deal. And because Obama tried to make a big deal out of it, he lost the support of a lot of Israelis. And then he lost the support of more Israelis when he gave a speech in Cairo, reaching out to the Arab and Muslim worlds, in which he said some good things about the need for the U.S. and Israel, about the bond between the U.S. and Israel being unbreakable, and about the need for there to be Arab and Muslim countries recognizing Israel, and talking about the Holocaust, which is important because there's a lot of Holocaust denial in the Muslim world. But also, he said a lot of negatives that really disturbed Israelis. After talking about the Holocaust, he said, on the other hand, the Palestinians have suffered too. Which made a lot of Israelis cringe. Not because it's not true. Palestinians have suffered, and we can feel bad about it. But we can't feel guilt. Not only can't you not compare anything to the Holocaust, anything, but if the Palestinians have suffered, it's because of their leadership that's failed them time and time again. Imagine if they would have said yes just a year ago when Ehud Olmert offered them two states for two peoples. He offered them to give up, he'd give up 100% of the West Bank, have thousands of Palestinians come into the final borders of the state of Israel, in addition to a Palestinian state. No Israeli government had even allowed in one, because there were more Jews expelled from Arab and Muslim countries than there were Arabs who fled the nascent state of Israel when it was created. And the offer to have the Holy Basin and the Old City of Jerusalem come under the international stewardship of five countries: Israel, the United States, the new Palestinian state, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. This is the same Olmert who we heard time and time again as mayor of Jerusalem say, Jerusalem will never be divided. The Palestinians turned that deal down. Imagine if they would have said yes, the Arabs, back in 1937, when they were offered two states or two peoples back then. Maybe there wouldn't have been a Holocaust. There would have already been a Jewish state, a haven for Jews from Europe, that would have had an air force that could have bombed the tracks on the way to Auschwitz, the way that FDR did not, saving hundreds of thousands of lives. And the reason why Israelis were so upset was he made it look as if the state of Israel was created because of the Holocaust, because of some European guilt, and therefore the Palestinians have suffered. Which is not true. Not only was there a Zionist movement way before the Holocaust, but imagine if you would have told the historical truth that Jews have been in the land of Israel not just since 1948, but since 1948. B.C. That was when Avraham Avinu was born. That was in the Parsha 3 weeks ago. A week later, in the Parsha, Hashem said to him, Lech Lecha, get out of here. And we've been in the land of Israel ever since. That was 75 years later. That was 3,800 years ago. And we've been there ever since, except for 298 years. Okay? 210 years, we were slaves in Egypt. 40 years making some wrong turns on the way back home. And then the exile in Babylonia, they'll tell you it was 70 years. Not true. The temple wasn't built for 70 years. But we were already allowed to come back after 48 years. They forget that. 48 years. So that's 250 plus 48, 298 years. That's all, out of the last 3,800. And if the reason why the speech was seen as such a missed opportunity is that one of the reasons why the Palestinians and the Arabs in general have never been willing to make concessions to help their own people is that they deny Jewish history. They deny Jewish peoplehood, and they deny Jewish sovereignty anywhere. Now, after this speech, I got my paper to take a poll and see what Israelis think about the President of the United States. And we were shocked by the results. We found that 40% of Israelis believe that the President is neutral, 50% believe that he is pro-Palestinian, and only 6% believe that the President of the United States is pro-Israel. So this is a problem. Israel needs America. Israel needs to have good relations with America. America acts as a strategic buffer between Israel and a more hostile world. Now, the Obama advisors saw this poll, and they were alarmed. They said, we've lost the support of mainstream Israel. We've lost their trust. We were depending on them to make a lot of concessions in the peace process. Now what are we going to do? They said, we can't allow this number to get any lower. And in fact, a few weeks later, it did. We took another poll and he fell to only 4%. Which if you think about it, is almost mathematically impossible. The poll had a margin of error of 4.5%. That meant that there were people who hadn't even been born yet who had a problem with the President of the United States. Now, from then on, the Obama administration started taking steps to try to improve their relations with Israel and with the Jewish people. Obama tried to get Arab leaders to make concessions to Israel. He visited the king of Saudi Arabia. He asked the king for some kind of gesture toward Israel. Let El Al planes fly over your airspace on the way to India, where Israeli soldiers, after they're done with the army, go to chill out. The king of Saudi Arabia responded with a long anti-Semitic rant. He refused to make any concession at all toward Israel. After that, Obama convened American Jewish leaders. He said to them, all the headlines about me putting pressure on Israel are exaggerated. I'm putting pressure on the Arab world too. He said, the Arab leaders are showing a profound lack of courage, which was a big statement for Obama, who has reached out so much to that Arab leadership. Then, a few weeks later, a month ago, there were the meetings that took place in the United Nations General Assembly, where Obama invited Netanyahu and forced Mahmoud Abbas to meet with him. And Obama made a point of putting his hand on Netanyahu's shoulder when the cameras were running, which wouldn't be a big deal normally. But Israelis saw this as very different body language than what he showed a few months ago, when he made a point of getting photographed talking to Netanyahu on the phone in the Oval Office with his shoes up on his desk. And shoes are in Islam, I know you don't learn the halacha of Islam here, but it's a very big insult. Shoes are a sign of humiliation. That's why one of them threw a shoe at Bush. And so this is from Arabist.net. This was broadcast around the Arab world as a sign that Obama is trying to humiliate Netanyahu. So we came a long way from this to this. Then there was the things that he said in his speeches in New York at the General Assembly. He talked about the need for the Arab world to be recognizing Israel as a Jewish state, which is a euphemism to Israeli ears of a complete end to the conflict, which is important. He also talked about the need for talks between Israel and the Palestinians to begin without preconditions, which is what Israel wanted. They had, on the Palestinians, a lot of preconditions. And he talked about the need for Israel to show restraint in the West Bank. Not a complete halt, all construction, natural growth, Jerusalem everywhere, like he did before, but just restraint, which Israel had been showing all along. So it was a long way that he came. Then the Obama administration was involved in trying to minimize the damage to Israel from the Goldstone report that alleged that there were atrocities that took place in Gaza on the part of Israel. And that was something appreciated. And then, over the last couple weeks, there's been Juniper Cobra, the largest military drill in the history of the State of Israel and America together. More than 1,000 American servicemen, 15 warships, all testing the ability of the United States and Israel to react to long-range and short-range missile attacks from Iran. Now, they're also testing the radar system that Israel received as a parting gift from the Bush administration. It's called X-BAM. It's a very sophisticated system. They only have three of them in the world. One guards the west coast of the United States. One guards the east coast of the United States. And the third is guarding Israel. And before we had the system, if a missile were fired from Iran, Israel would have enough time to fire two missiles to bring it down. One Israeli Arrow missile, one American missile, less good range. But since this new radar system is in place, which can detect anything in the air more than 1,000 miles away, the size of a softball, Israel would have enough time to fire four missiles to try to bring it down. Sorry about your tape recording. Okay. It still works. Okay, and so this is important. Now, on the Iranian issue, Obama has come toward Israel as well. At first, when Netanyahu took over, he sent the director of the CIA to warn Israel, don't you dare attack Iran. To say America's top issue, top priority, is Iraq. And because of that, they want to have open-ended engagement with Iran, which means no deadlines. Netanyahu convinced them, you've got to set a deadline. And he announced in the press conference in May with Netanyahu that he would have a reassessment of the diplomatic approach to handling Iran at the end of this year, December. There are four different ways to prevent the nuclearization of Iran. There is the political approach, the diplomatic approach, the economic approach, and the military approach. The political approach was the election in Iran. It wasn't allowed to be democratic. It didn't work. And yet, there's still rioting going on to this very day. The last time, 30 years ago, last month, was the revolution in Iran. It took them a year and a half to overthrow it with the rioting that they have there. So that can still work. Then there's the diplomatic approach, which the world has clearly run out of patience with. The economic approach is going to be beginning already next month. Netanyahu believes the economic approach can work. As he said, never underestimate the weakness of the regime in Iran. Never underestimate the strength of the West. And he said, the economic approach works in three ways. First of all, you've got the international economic crisis that hurts Iran. Second of all, you've got the lower price of gas and oil, which was done by oil-producing nations in order to hurt Iran because they're scared of Iran. And last but not least are the sanctions that Israel believes that can be intensified to what Hillary Clinton calls crippling sanctions and then can be successful if they're very, very serious sanctions. But being Israeli is about hoping for the best and preparing for the worst. That's why you had those military drills. There have been a lot of different kinds of drills. If you were sitting on a beach in Greece in June 2008, you'd have seen dozens of Israeli fighter jets hovering overhead on a dry run of what it'd be like to attack Iran in the opposite direction, same distance. I myself participated in a drill in May. I serve in the spokesman's unit of the army, Dover Tzahal. I was called in to the headquarters of the Air Force. I had no idea why I was there until they told me, well, we're doing a drill, and we want you in this drill to play the role of the foreign press. All of it around the world. I said, okay, that sounds like fun. What are you going to be drilling? And they said, well, we'll be drilling attacking Syria. We'll be drilling attacking Lebanon. Then they whispered, we're also going to be drilling attacking Iran. Then I got excited. Here I was being told a military secret. I came home. I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell my wife even. I felt like I had, even though Ishto Kikufo. You can tell your wife anything. But I felt like I had to tell somebody. So I told my dog. Okay, my dog is very good at keeping secrets. 3 days later, I turn on the nightly news. And I see the lead headline to the nightly news is, Israel just finished its two-day drill attacking Iran. I gave my dog a look. What have you done? Then I see a minute later, it was actually Israel's defense minister, Ehud Barak, bragging about this drill, what he called the two-day drill attacking Iran. But I was still confused, because I went into journalism because I'm not so good at math, but 1, 2, 3 I could handle. It was a 3-day drill. Why did he call it a 2-day drill? What happened on the first day? The President of the United States hosted the Prime Minister of Israel at the White House. Apparently, Ehud Barak did not want the world to know that while the Prime Minister of Israel is trying to persuade the President of the United States to take action against Iran, Israel was getting ready just in case he doesn't. So, Obama did come a long way towards seeing the Iranian issue the way Israel does. He did come a little bit of a way to seeing the Palestinian issue the more the way Israel does, and also the way the two issues work together. In the press conference between Netanyahu and Obama, Netanyahu said, "Mr. President, if you prevent the nuclearization of Iran, that can give a big boost to the peace process." Obama said, "No, I see it the other way. If I solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that can give me a big boost in stopping the nuclearization of Iran." The Israelis heard this and they said, "Huh? Or eh? We've been trying to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for more than 61 years. We can't wait another 61 years to prevent the nuclearization of Iran. That's something very urgent." And now Obama and the rest of the world, they've put Iran at the top of their agenda, which is very, very important. From Israel's standpoint, there's nothing more important than eliminating this existential threat to Israel. So things are getting better, Baruch Hashem. There's still a long way to go to improve the relationship between the United States and Israel. There's a whole debacle over the past week with Obama trying to make Netanyahu sweat by not telling him whether they'd even meet, but then the meeting went well. So there's still going to be problems. It's not going to be an easy next few years. But the most important thing is that the world is now taking action that it wasn't doing before to prevent the nuclearization of Iran, and that you have an Israeli government that will do everything possible to protect the security of its people. But it's not only the Israeli government doing it, it's also you learning Torah over here, day in and day out, where every moment of your learning Torah helps make Israel a safer and better place. Thank you very much. Purposely left time so there can be questions. Feel free to ask me. Okay. That SMS was somebody getting back to me from last night. I wish would have called me last night. So when I call on you, just say your name and where you're from. Yeah.
From where?
Okay.